Pittsburgh, I love ya. This is Brian Edward, and you're listening to Berg Vivant, Pittsburgh's cultural talk magazine, delivered digitally, straight up, shaken, and stirred. Tonight's broadcast brought to you by our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Zafalo's Banquet and Event Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, one of the most beautiful and unique venues in the greater Pittsburgh area for weddings, corporate dinners, fundraisers, and more. Visit clubzafalo.com. Off the Wall Theater, enlivening, educating, and entertaining audiences in the Pittsburgh region. View their current season at insideoffthewall.com. Arcade Comedy Theater, hosting local and national comedians, sketch comedy, improv, and more. 811 Liberty Avenue, downtown. Be sure to like them on Facebook or find them at arcadecomedytheater.com. Berg Vivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. You can learn more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. Tonight's guest, violinist, composer, conductor, teacher, writer, senior lecturer, and director of University of Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, Roger Zahab. Thank you for being here tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Now, did I cover everything? Does that...
I think that's pretty much.
Excellent.
Pretty much.
And we could be here for a while, yeah. I know. But as always, we like to break the ice with an offbeat local headline, and one that I plucked out today from one of our fine Pittsburgh media outlets. Ex-Pittsburgh mayoral candidate A.J. Richardson, and this, of course, was the man who is probably most known for his creative facial tattoos, which, as far as facial tattoos go, I think were quite impressive. A.J. Richardson waives hearing on assault and drunkenness charges. Now, with this headline, it is not my intent to get into politics or Mr. Richardson's capabilities as perhaps mayor of Pittsburgh, but what he was accused of was fighting with the police and poking his neighbor under the eye. Not in the eye, but under the eye. Now, under what circumstances could you imagine that you may resort to using this as a way of defending yourself?
Wow. Well, I think that the element of surprise and scaring someone without doing too much damage would be the best reasoning.
What you'd expect.
I would not expect that.
He was not going for my eyeball, he was going for under the eye.
Right.
It's reminiscent to me of Three Stooges a little bit.
Yeah, almost as if he saw something there and he had to get it off real quick, like a gnat or a wasp.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But, you know, it's not very threatening, you know, but I guess if you didn't get the wall up soon enough. Now this, you know, you as a very accomplished musician, how would you handle it if your sight was impaired for a long period of time, or maybe permanently? How would that change your approach to music?
Well, I'd rely on hearing even more than I already do. And I would have to work on my memory, which is not always very good. I rarely play music from memory because I always want to switch things around.
Are there notable blind violinists?
Well, there was a famous violinist who was blinded by his E string breaking in a concert. It broke and put out his left eye. It actually happened in the late 1800s,
wow.
I think.
Now, is there a risk of that happening today, or was that sort of old-school violin?
I'm very comfortable wearing glasses for that reason. I actually can get a little paranoid about strings.
So the violin business is a little risky.
It's dangerous. It's very dangerous.
Oh, I'm glad you survived to chat with us today. That's fantastic. But, you know, what first inspired you? Where did you get your roots with music and with the violin in particular?
Well, I always... as a kid, I always heard music, not exactly as a soundtrack, but it seemed to surround me. And I was always singing and hitting things. Percussion was my first instrument, kitchen pots and pans, and then I got some bongo drums. And I was always listening to music and asking to hear records played, very specific records, even before I could read. And then lessons were offered in the public schools in Akron Ohio in, I think it must have been the beginning of fourth grade, a letter was sent to parents and orchestral instruments were available, and I took it to my mom and she said, well, your grandfather liked the violin. And I said, well, I like the idea of playing the violin. It's much easier to carry than cellos or, you know, brass instruments. So I started playing the violin, and my first teacher was an amazing character named Henry Gladigan. And I remember we were an inner city school, and all of us were either children of immigrants or, I mean, we were all working class kids. And he went around to everyone in the circle and asked them who they were and where they were from and played something that was related to their background or their experience. It was amazing. He was a real personality. And he set me off on the path that I have not swerved from since.
So from percussion to violin, and what's interesting is it was the idea of playing the violin that it sounds like first attracted.
The idea, and then I thought, oh, the violin, I could play in an orchestra, or I could, I mean, in those days when I watched television, I was always drawn to the soundtracks, and I certainly was interested in all the music that was played in the house. On records, and it was like the violin was a key to pay greater attention to all the experiences that were happening around. So I just sort of drifted from one thing to the next, and pretty soon I was spending 2 or 3 hours just messing around with the violin, driving my parents crazy and the neighbors. And I think that I had no idea what I was getting into. It was only when I was in middle school and high school when I realized how important it really was. So.
And throughout your career, you've worked with some incredible names in the music industry. What were some of the most notable that you've come across?
Well, I think, aside from a number of musicians, now, what am I going to say?
Probably, you want to flatter people. I think that's what you're going to say. You want to be kind.
I mean, the thing is that...
you don't want to say somebody's not notable. I understand.
I mean...
Everyone's notable.
To me, I think that when you're playing music and you hear something that grabs your attention, that is notable. You don't, I never worried whether they were famous or not. I only worried whether I could collaborate with them. And whether they were interested in the skills that I had to offer. And I think that every person I've collaborated with pointed out to me that there were more skills to be learned. So I kind of chose my collaborators partly for what additional tools I could add to my arsenal. But certainly the most remarkable experience was working with someone like John Cage. I actually heard his Apartment House 1776 when it was played in Cleveland, Ohio. That was a American Bicentennial Commission. The major orchestras in the United States each chose a composer to commission, and I think that was the Boston Orchestra's choice. And they did a consortium grant, and so I went up to Cleveland and saw that it was paired with Mahler's Fifth Symphony. And I remember that they seemed to go very well together, although I'm not sure the friends I went with agreed. And I walked up to him and told him it was amazing, and he was very kind, and that was it. And then a few years later, I went to graduate school at Stony Brook, State University of New York at Stony Brook, and we decided to give a concert of John Cage's music and invite him out. And that is when I actually started working with him. He sent me the first six of a set of etudes called the Freeman Etudes, and we wrote a little note and said, please call me if you have any questions. So I opened the music, my jaw dropped, and I called him immediately because I couldn't understand anything that was on the page, and he gave me a quick overview of how to approach it. I started practicing, and then I went into the city and played for him, and it was an ear-opening experience and a mind-opening experience, too. And then he introduced me to my violin teacher, Paul Zukofsky, who was destined to be the final. I've had great teachers from Henry Gladigan all the way up to Paul Zukofsky, and that last one I have to thank John Cage for.
And John Cage is certainly one of the most prolific American composers, I think, of the last century, last two centuries. But for those who might be listening that aren't really familiar with what makes him unique as a composer, can you give us John Cage in a nutshell? It's a monumental task, I'm sure.
That was it.
Oh, very good.
Silence. He is, well, it's interesting. When I would be walking with him down a sidewalk in New York, people who are not musicians, I mean, you can sort of tell when there are musicians because you know them. I mean, you know, but there are artists, and there were playwrights and architects, and people who are not musicians for whom he was a very famous figure. And I think that part of it is that he was a philosopher and a pundit is not the right word. He was a thinker. He was an artist. He made graphic, not only graphic scores, but he did etchings and watercolors. He was very much involved in collaboration with dancers. He was the music director for the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. And actually, that's how he made his living in his early career. And so he was a great... he got people together and helped create collaborations. And I think that in American arts, he may have a greater impact, actually, as a person who got that collaborative ferment going. Musicians tend to feel very strongly one way or another about him. And I think it's because... for most musicians, music has a very strong scent. There is sentiment, and there is memory, and there is also a great deal of emotion involved in music. And it is taught as a long line of creative, usually men, writing music to express themselves. And Cage was one of the very first composers to say, "I'm not interested in expressing myself. I'm interested in hearing sounds separate from what I feel about them." And so that leads you into quite a corridor of complicated passageways, thought-wise.
Yeah. You know, the thing I'll say about Cage, and I am by no means a music scholar, I'm certainly a music appreciator, but he consistently challenges my understanding of music. Mm-hmm. And I like to think that he would appreciate that.
Oh, yes.
You know, I think that's what I can give. I mean, like I said, I'm a music appreciator. I played trombone in high school band. I was terrible. I couldn't read music. I still to this day can't read music. But trombone, you know, you kind of just slide it around until you figure it out. You can pass, you know. But so now I kind of just like taking a seat and enjoying it. And when I get to, you know, the works of John Cage, what strikes me more so than the content is the philosophy of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes me think, well, gee, you know, it challenges my understanding of what music is, what a composition is, and actually causes me to listen to more around mm-hmm. me yeah. than what's present in his recording.
Well, I think that, for instance, he thought of music as something that people did live. He actually did not like recordings, and he had no use for them.
Hmm.
So he didn't collect recordings. He okayed. I mean, you could say that there's a contradiction there because he approved recordings. He made recordings because he was asked to,
mm-hmm.
but he himself didn't use them. He would rather just listen to the sounds right, that were happening.
So, for example, I mean, let's point out probably the most notable four minutes and 33 seconds, which is 4 minutes and 33 seconds of, would it be appropriate to say, silence? Not really, because that 4 minutes and 33 seconds is composed of the sound that happens.
Yes.
And that is the piece. That is the music, in a sense.
Right, and there's another layer in the idea of 4 minutes and 33 seconds, because it is a composition that is copyright.
That's got to be tricky. You must have had some good lawyers.
It's brought a lot of questions. He conceived of the idea, and he wrote it originally in a graphic score in which time equals space. So it's like a timeline.
And it's that formula would be copywritten. So I couldn't do 4 minutes and 54 seconds.
You could. Actually, there's a second version, which is 0 minutes, 0 seconds, which can be performed in any way by anyone for any length of time.
Oh, he was kind.
And that's a score. You know, he's very flexible. But the thing is that it's an idea written down. So here's a score, and it's in three movements, and it's for a performer. It's often done. He played it at the piano.
Mm-hmm.
So there are three movements. They're very carefully identified. I forget, there are three different timings for each of the movements, and they add up to 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And so there's a dramatic frame, and that frame is that the performer walks out on stage, opens the score, and begins performing and does nothing. So the first movement is performed, then the page is turned, the second movement is performed, the third movement is performed, and then that's the end of the piece. So for an audience, there is already this question of, there's a performer, and he or she is engaged in performing, but they're not doing anything. And as I demonstrated at the beginning, the essence of John Cage is partly the discipline of paying attention to anything. I mean, if there is something, then you pay attention to it because it's there. But if it's not there and you're paying attention, you discover quickly, as you do when you listen to 4 minutes and 33 seconds, that something else is going on. There is always a sound, many sounds.
With every
sometimes.
Generation, there is more and more distraction. So,
yes, it's getting noisier.
Right. So, how do you feel his works and philosophies are appreciated today as opposed to in his own time? Oh. Has it changed? Has it developed? Has it diminished? Has it increased?
I think he was very much appreciated in his own time, partly because when it seemed like a new idea, he was very quick to say that, to always mention people who inspired him. For instance, the idea of 4 minutes and 33 seconds, the idea of silence, he got from a Robert Rauschenberg, a series of paintings, which were white canvases. And he said, I saw these canvases, and I was struck by the fact that shadows and dust flying around, anything could be projected on them. And if you you think that it has nothing in it. And then when you look at it, you see that there are that it's a very dynamic, changing field. Mm-hmm. It changes with the time of day. It changes with the lighting in the room. And he himself was a very dynamic person. So I think that he became a very charismatic figure, and that in his day, not only were his ideas interesting, and he wrote about them, he wrote many books, and he spoke about them very often, but it was a way to engage with a way of living that isn't about historical straight line. Mm-hmm. And that was very important in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
And the 70s. And I think that towards the end of his life, I knew him the last 12 years of his life, he became more and more John Cage. Like, not exactly a brand, but he became his own it's very hard to figure out how to describe it. It's like he was a living, breathing person, but when you saw him in public, he had a role that he had to play.
He was playing John
and he
Cage.
Was playing, yeah. He was himself playing John Cage, and I felt that he was more and more trapped in that. And then he died suddenly, right before his 80th birthday. And all the people who knew him as a friend and as a mentor missed him terribly. And then after that, an industry has popped up around John Cage. And the ideas are influential, and they are always subject to reinterpretation and misinterpretation, and every person who had a conversation with him might very well have a different idea of what that idea means now at a distance. And he spoke, even in his lectures in Harvard, he spoke about the fallibility of memory. When he's remembering what happened, or when he's telling a story, it's what he thinks he remembered. And he and I and you, we all discover that our memories are constantly being reconfigured.
Yeah, I could see that happening to me. I really could. But, you know, so out of the spotlight, you know, when just one-on-one, when mm-hmm. he was really, as you might describe, himself, what was it like mm-hmm. having a conversation with him?
Well, he was a very, he was very fun and very sweet person, and also he did have this gift of being able to listen. So he seemed genuinely interested in the dialogue end of the conversation, whereas in public, because he was always asked to speak, he ended up repeating himself, you know, saying the same things over and over again. And I think that any public figure probably ends up doing that. But I think that in private, he had an interest in personality, which is, he had a very interesting personality, and I think that he wanted to be around people who were interesting and surprising in their own way, and also had a gift for conversation and sometimes just the ability to just sit quietly. I mean, I've attended concerts with him, I've had meals with him, and it was not hard work. Whereas with some people who are very famous, it can be difficult to just, you know, they sort of need to be at the center of things.
Now, I thought it was interesting that you had mentioned earlier one of his inspirations came from canvas art. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes think of John Cage, what John Cage is to music in some ways Andy Warhol was to art, in the sense that John Cage could portray what we might see as silence as music, and Andy Warhol could take a soup can and mm-hmm. and portray that as art. There's kind of been a parallel in my mind well, between the two?
I think probably closer, instead of Warhol, who I think that Warhol is someone who's always managing things artfully. And I think that John was not managing, I think Warhol's managing the reception and hoping for certain things and certainly getting them and doing a great job. I mean, it's interesting. He had, I ran into him a few times and I felt that
Warhol?
Yes, and I actually, we sort of caught each other's eye one day on Second Avenue, and I was struck by the fact that he was instantly recognizable, but sort of not uncomfortable occupying a space, but trying to occupy his little, I mean, his sort of iconic wig, and very happy to be noticed, but always outward gazed, and always sort of trying to see what your reaction was and how his work was being received.
As possible under a giant white wig and sunglasses.
Right, yes, as subtle as possible. But I think that he is not a good parallel as much as someone like Marcel Duchamp, who also liked to repurpose things in a way that he couldn't foretell how they would be received. I mean, certainly I think he enjoyed attention like Cage did, but I think that part of the interest for them in their interior lives was to have an idea, put it out there in as sometimes dramatic of action, fashion, or sometimes as anonymously, and to see what the result is. For instance, when you come across a ready-made by Duchamp, your mind is sort of wrestling with a confusing thing. There is a urinal, right? But it's in a museum. But it's still a urinal, and there's nothing about it that detracts from that identity except for the signature. So that's like Cage's
that's
4 minutes and 33
comparison.
Seconds,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, there's this silence, but there's a signature on the score. And the most interesting thing about it is not the object in a way, it's about your live reaction to it and your wrestling with that idea.
It's very much in the present.
Yes, exactly.
Do recordings.
Exactly.
Do you find that he comes up in your career often these days?
I think about him very often, and it's usually when I am in a situation and I'm living in it. And I think of him very often when I play his music, which remains absorbing to me but very difficult. But my music is not like his at all, although for a while I have used chance operations in ways similar that he has. My music has gone away from not wanting to manage audience reaction to wanting to manage it. So I have, as a musician, been trained by wrestling with his music, and I feel that it's made me a better musician, and I try and play it as faithfully as I can, but my own work is not like his. Where he crops up is that people often want to know what he was like.
Case in point.
Case in point. And it's, I can't, I'm in an interesting situation where I actually spent a fair amount of time with him and asked him many questions, and he was always very good about answering them truthfully without too much. He didn't think before he answered. I mean, he thought while he was answering, but they were always practical questions, and he gave always practical answers. And this is maybe a perspective that's quite apart from the legend of John Cage. And so I think I'm not an expert the way some are, but having had the experience of those practical matters, it's a good window into his personality and his working methods.
Yeah, thank you for sharing it. It was a lot of great insight and great conversation about how it works, you know, bounces off other forms of art too. Mm-hmm. So tell me about your experience here in the Pitt Music Department. What keeps you busy on a daily basis in these parts?
Okay, well, it's the quality of living with other interesting people that keeps me in Pittsburgh. I think it's a great city. And the University of Pittsburgh is a wonderful collection of interesting people, and the music department has become a very comfortable home for me. Mm. This is my 20th year in the music department, and I originally, Eric Moe, a friend that I had made a few years before, at the end of the 80s and beginning of the 90s, called me up one day. This was before email. We didn't use email that much. Called me up and said, our violin teacher has moved on and we need someone to teach a few violin students. And would you be interested? He knew that I was already driving to Mount Union College from Akron to teach one day a week. And I said, sure, I'd be very happy to do that. And then he said, oh, and by the way, do you know any graduate student who would like to conduct the orchestra? It's a community orchestra and it's very small. And I said, well, I don't know of any graduate students who would do it, but I would be very happy to do it and I'll be there, so maybe I can teach on the day that the orchestra meets. And I spoke with Don Franklin, who was the chair at that time, and he admitted that that maybe the orchestra was not going to make it through the year. But it was too late. The semester had begun and a few students had signed up for it and they needed to have someone. So if I would be willing to deal with it, they would have me. To deal with the orchestra. Jeez. And I remember that the first downbeat was the most amazing sound. I actually said, I don't know where to begin. Because
because it was that good or that lousy?
It was, well, I couldn't call it lousy, but it was just really interesting. It was supposed to have only three notes in it, but everyone had a different idea of what those three notes were.
You know, that's a very polite description.
It's a Cajun description.
Bravo.
But it was great because everyone was from a different walk of life. There were some community people, there were faculty, great molecular biologist, bacteriologist who was in there. There were some undergraduates. Yes, the head of the Bacteriophage Institute, Roger Hendricks.
I bet you everybody sat two chairs away from that.
No, he was, he's wonderful, and he still plays in the orchestra, and I'm very glad to have him. He's a wonderful clarinetist, and another Rogers. So Roger is not a very common name anymore, so it's good to have company. And then there were some students, and then some people who'd been in the orchestra since it was founded in 1976. And at that point, it had been turned into a community orchestra, and I slowly moved it back into being a real university ensemble. Mm. And so in the first year, there were about, I think, 12 people in the orchestra, and we had to hire a lot of ringers to come in and play for the concerts. And now, today, it has about 75 people in it, and most of them are undergraduates at Pitt.
Wow, great.
There are a few faculty, there are a few graduate students, there are a few community people who are very welcome. And we do now 6 concerts a year, and we play Mahler symphonies. And although they may not be musically perfect, they are musically lively.
Well, I think it's hard to be musically perfect.
Yes, I haven't heard it yet, and yet much more important to me is that they're unforgettable experiences. So there are great orchestras who make unforgettable performances, and then there are community orchestras who do the same. And I think that maybe the level of music making and skill is different, but the engagement with the music can be very similar.
So you have saved this orchestra single-handedly,
well,
almost.
And maybe I've saved them and they've saved me a few times.
Isn't this kind of what happened in Mr. Holland's Opus? Or am I...
I think that this is a little more complicated than Mr. Holland's
Opus. Sister Act was like this, too.
Maybe more like Sister Act,
there you
yes.
go. She came in, you know,
she came
scrubbed
in.
Them out, and they played for the Pope. So,
that's right.
And you know, there might be something like that.
I think, what we do is we get to play for a very engaged audience. And
that is its own reward.
It is its own reward, and they keep coming back for more. Our audience has grown. So, and the other thing about the orchestra is that... these are people who are mostly not music majors, and yet they play beautifully. I mean,
wow.
It's an amazing orchestra. This year we're going to play three works by Benjamin Britten in honor of his centennial. The first concert it probably will have happened by the time you see this, but David Russell, a wonderful cellist, is playing the Cello Symphony by Britten. And then Rob Frankenberry is going to sing the Nocturne, which is the second of the two works for tenor and string orchestra. Nocturne has solo wind, and I think there's a timpani solo, a harp solo, and I'm going to enroll the help of my faculty, colleagues, and guest artists. And then we will also do his last orchestra work in April, the Suite on English Folk Songs, which is a wonderful, unforgettable piece. And these are major works, and they're very difficult, and I know that my orchestra can play them beautifully. So the orchestra has come along, and it's come along with the department, which is, we have a great BA program there's a master's, and there's a minor in music, a Bachelor of Arts for majors and for minors. And the great thing about that is that you can do that degree and do two, three, or four others. We've had a quadruple major or two.
Great.
And they're usually scientists and philosophers and musicians all rolled into one. And then the graduate program has developed into something amazing that it's of international renown. So we have programs in ethnomusicology, composition, / music theory, historical musicology, and jazz. And I think I'm forgetting something.
Do you find that Pitt has become a destination for music?
It has. The Music on the Edge series presents internationally known performers and ensembles of new music of all kinds in Belfield Hall. We also collaborate with the Warhol Museum and present some concerts there.
Great.
And then we have a great gamelan ensemble and a Carpathian ensemble, and so they perform music from mostly Eastern Europe and local artists are involved in that, and as well as students. And then we also collaborate with other area organizations. Music majors and graduate students have performed at the Carnegie Museum of Art, and actually we have something in the works. I can't talk about it yet, but we have it coming up for the international. So that should be
that's
very
big.
Interesting. Yeah.
When can you talk about it?
I'll let you know.
All right.
We're still trying to get all of our ducks in a row.
Now, when do you get to perform? When do you get to play the violin?
I play every day for students and lessons. We play back and forth to each other. I'm performing a week with my group Entelechron. That's Monday, the 23rd of September. I'm going to play with Donna Amato, the pianist, and Paula Tuttle, the cellist, on the faculty. We're going to do the Beethoven Triple Concerto in January, I think end of January in Sewickley, and beginning of February at Our concert series in Belfield Hall.
Excellent. Now tell me about Intellicron. Is it a solid group, or are there guest artists that are coming and going through it?
It's a solid group, and we are very flexible. We have collaborators and consultants join us for various concerts. The core ensemble is David Russell, the cellist, Rob Frankenberry, the pianist and tenor, and myself on violin and viola. And Eric Moe has joined us as pianist, and we play music. Mm-hmm. We play music of friends and people we'd like to have as friends. We have one recording out called Intellicron Time Plus Memory. And we've given concerts in New York City, in Vermont, and Pittsburgh, and we have other concerts in the works for Boston. And
the recording, again, is Time?
Time Plus Memory.
Time Plus Memory. And it is available?
It's available on iTunes, CD Baby, Amazon, Spotify.
It's out there.
It's out there.
Might we take a listen to a sample?
Yes.
Let's hear
it. That would be great.
An excerpt from How to Sing Properly. How did that get its name?
One of my students, a cellist in the orchestra, Ben Ristow, has a home chamber music ensemble ready-made. His mom is a violinist and his grandmother is a pianist. And I wrote a piece, I think it was for his 21st birthday. It's a piano trio that he could play with his mom and grandmother. And so I wrote this piece, and they tried it out at home. I guess they liked it.
Yeah.
So the style of the piece is partly to highlight Ben's he has a great lyrical gift when he plays the cello. He makes a beautiful sound. And the piano part is his grandmother's sort of honors her. She's an avid chamber musician and loves to play piano repertoire, and she likes romantic music particularly. And so I tried to write something that would be good for her. And the violin and the cello go very well together, so I think they enjoyed playing it.
Okay. Well, we can find Intellicron at website, Facebook.
Yes, my website is rogerzahab.net,
mm-hmm.
And information about upcoming performances will be posted on that.
Excellent, yep. Excellent, very good. So what do you do when you're not playing the violin, teaching the violin? What do you like to get out and do in Pittsburgh?
I do like to go on walks. I love theater and visiting museums. I love to eat.
What's your guilty pleasure?
Sanctuary,
I think. I've heard good things about it. I haven't been. What's the dish du jour there? What's the
well, it changes every
on?
Week, but I loved to have Actually, there are a number of, I have to say that Tender is has some great food, and that's a great cocktail.
Yes, I love the atmosphere.
Establishment as well. And I'm very partial to the scene at Harris Grill,
mm-hmm.
which is fits my schedule very well. I can go there anytime
yeah.
I'm hungry and eat really good food and have fine beverages.
You ever been to Bacon Night there?
Yes.
Tuesdays are Bacon Night.
Yes, they certainly are, and I've been there many times.
So we can see you with a
you can find me at Harris Grill.
A basket of bacon at Harris Grill. I'm going to look for you.
I go easy on the bacon, but I...
Come on, live a little, you know? That's great. That's
good.
Great. Well, we'll see you out and about, and hopefully catch one of your performances here as well as the orchestra. Here at Pitt. That's all great news. Good. So, Roger, thank you for chatting with
us. It's my pleasure.
Oh, pleasure chatting with you. Absolutely.
In closing, we would like to once again thank our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Off the Wall Theater, Cefalo's Banquet and Events Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Arcade Comedy Theater, Downtown, and Berg Pavant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. Find out more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. And be sure to follow Pittsburgh's Cultural Talk magazine online. You can find Berg Vivant, the It in Pittsburgh, on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribe for free at www.bergvivant.com. This is Brian Edwards saying cheers and good night.